Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're jumping into, well, the history of electricity, how we figured it out and started using it.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story.
We've got some great sources here covering everything from ancient encounters with electric fish, right up to batteries, electromagnetism, and even the microchip.
Right.
And we know you want the deep understanding fast. So that's the plan. Pull out the really key stuff, the compelling bits, without getting lost in the weeds.
Absolutely. And our mission, you know, it's just the simple version.
Like Franklin and the kite.
Exactly. We want to go way beyond that. Explore the whole journey, all the layers that led to, well, everything that powers our lives now. Batteries, motors, chips, the works.
Okay, let's do it. So where does this story actually kick off?
It starts really, really early, long before anyone was talking about electricity. But our sources show ancient people definitely noticed it.
How so?
Well, the Egyptians, way back like 2750 BC, they knew about electric fish in the Nile. Called them the Thunderer of the Nile.
Wow, Thunderer of the Nile. That's quite a name.
Tells you something, right? Imagine getting zapped by one.
Yeah, you'd remember it.
And it wasn't just them. Later writers, Pliny the Elder, for instance, they described the numbing effect of electric catfish and torpedo rays.
So they felt the shock.
They did. And what's really interesting is they noted the shock could travel along things, like metal spear tips, maybe, an early grasp of conductivity, perhaps.
So even way back then, a sense that something was being transmitted.
A glimmer, yeah. But for centuries, it was just this weird natural quirk.
It's a strange phenomenon.
Right. One source says exactly that it stayed a strange phenomenon until really the 17th century.
Okay, so what changed in the 17th century?
That's when we see a shift towards, let's say, proper inquiry. William Gilbert, around 1600, he was really the first to study it systematically, scientifically.
Got it. So the start of trying to figure it out properly, what came next?
Well, the 17th century and onwards, lots more experimenting, especially with static electricity.
It's like rubbing balloons.
Kind of. Around 1660, Otto von Guericke built a machine basically to generate static electricity on demand. A spinning sulfur ball, I think.
Right, a way to make the sparks fly controllably. Still a long way from plugging things in, though.
Oh, absolutely. Then fast forward to 1745, Peter van Musschenbroek, a Dutch physicist, invents the Leyden jar.
The Leyden jar, I've heard of that. What was it?
It was basically the first capacitor, a way to store static electricity.
Store it. Okay, that feels like a big step.
It was huge, but also dangerous. Our timeline mentions his friend Cneus got a near-fatal shock from it.
Whoa. Seriously.
Yeah, imagine that experiment going wrong. A shocking discovery, literally.
No kidding. So early electricity wasn't exactly safe.
Definitely not. And around the same time, 1747, you have Benjamin Franklin. He came up with his one fluid theory.
Positive and negative charges.
That's the one. Introduced positive and negative. But interestingly, his model actually caused some, well, lasting confusion about which way current actually flows.
Ah, right. The whole conventional current versus electron flow thing that still trips people up.
Exactly. Even Franklin didn't nail everything first time. But he also observed something crucial. Electricity acting at a distance.
An invisible force.
Kind of. It suggested some kind of field, which was a pretty radical idea then.
Okay, so we're understanding static, storing it a bit. But what about moving electricity, the stuff that does work?
Right. That's the next massive leap. Early 19th century, the dawn of electromagnetism.
Electromagnetism. Sounds important.
Hugely. The key moment is often cited as 1820 with Hans Christian Oersted.
What did he do?
It was apparently accidental. He noticed an electric current in a wire deflected a nearby compass needle.
Just noticed it. Like, huh, that's weird.
Pretty much. But it was the first clear link. Electricity causing magnetism, causing movement. A mechanical effect from electricity.
That is big. A total accident revealing a fundamental connection.
Well, maybe not total accident. Oersted, apparently, back around 1813, had already been thinking forces of nature were connected. He even wondered if electricity could affect magnets.
Ah, so he had an inkling.
Seems so. And get this, one source mentions he carried an early battery, a voltaic cell, on his travels years before. So he was definitely probing these ideas.
Okay, so the observation confirmed his suspicions. What happened once Oersted published this?
All hell broke loose. Scientifically speaking, people jumped on it. André Marie Ampère, just a week later.
A week? That's fast.
Incredibly fast. Ampère showed that parallel wires with currents attract or repel each other. And in that same year, 1820, he invented the solenoid.
The coil thing.
Yeah, the coil of wire, foundational stuff.
It really does sound like a chain reaction. One discovery sparking the next.
It totally was. Then, 1821, Michael Faraday. his electromagnetic rotation experiments, he got a wire to continuously spin around a magnet.
So turning electricity into continuous motion.
Precisely. A massive step towards the electric motor, showing you could get sustained movement.
They were figuring out how to make this invisible force do things.
And making it stronger.
Yeah.
1825, William Sturgeon invents the electromagnet.
Wow.
By wrapping the wire coil around an iron core. Suddenly, the magnetic field was much, much stronger. Controllable magnetism.
Okay, now that sounds like something you could use, like in a motor.
Exactly. And people were definitely thinking about motors. Over in the U.S. around 1831, Joseph Henry discovered induction independently.
Induction, like generating current.
Right, the principle behind generators.
Mm-hmm.
And he also built this thing called a magnetic rocker. Some say that was the first real electric motor.
So multiple people, different places, all circling around motors and generators. Let's focus on the motors. What do these early ones look like?
Well, you had Peter Barlow's wheel in 1822, a sort of spinning disc thing.
Okay.
Then, a bit later, 1827 or 28, a Hungarian inventor, István Csedlik, made a rotary machine. It used electromagnets and a commutator.
Commutator? What's it do?
It's like an automatic switch. It reverses the current direction at the perfect moment to keep the motor spinning.
Hmm.
Really clever and essential for many motors.
Ah, okay. Keeps it going round and round.
Yeah. But Csedlik, he didn't publish his work for ages, so it didn't really influence others immediately.
Right. Discovery isn't enough. You have to share it. Any others?
Sure. 1832, Salvatore Dal Negro in Italy. He made a device that could lift a weight using electromagnetism.
Okay, actually doing work.
And July 1832, the first public description of a rotating electric machine. Probably by a guy called Frederick McClintock in Ireland.
So things are accelerating.
Definitely. And by the 1830s, they were starting to distinguish clearly between machines that make electricity generators and machines that use electricity to make motion motors.
The two sides of the coin.
Right. Now, you often hear about Thomas Davenport, American inventor, patented a motor in 1837.
A U.S. first.
It was the first U.S. patent for one. But, our sources point out, Europe was arguably ahead. Moritz Jacobi in Russia built a much more powerful motor in 1834.
Earlier and more powerful.
Yeah. And Strating and Becker in the Netherlands built a little electric model car in 1835.
An electric car in 1835? Seriously?
A small model, yeah. But shows the thinking. So, while Davenport's patent was a milestone, these European efforts were probably more influential at the time.
It really highlights how science builds globally, doesn't it? So what happened with Davenport's motor? Did it take off?
Well, he kept working. He even built an electric printing press around 1840.
Printing newspapers with electricity.
Trying to, but the big problem for all these early motors was the power source. Batteries were just too expensive and not powerful enough, especially compared to steam engines.
Ah, the power source. Batteries. We need to talk about them. Where do they come into the story?
Well, the earliest sort of potential battery is way older. The Baghdad battery.
Oh, yeah, those mysterious pots. Around 250 BC to 224 AD.
That's the ones. Terracotta pots, copper sheets, iron rods.
What do people think they were for? Still a mystery.
Still debated. Maybe medicine? Rituals? Sure. Maybe, just maybe, electroplating? We don't really know for sure. It's tantalizing.
Like finding an alien artifact. Okay, so skipping ahead, what about batteries people actually used for experiments?
Right, you get the development of wet cell batteries. Volta's pile was a key early one, but they used liquid electrolytes.
And liquids can be messy.
Exactly. Prone to leaks, as one source puts it. Not great if you want to carry your power source around.
Definitely limits portability.
Hugely. The big breakthrough for portability came late in the 19th century. The dry cell battery.
Dry cell? How does that work?
Instead of a liquid, it uses a damp paste electrolyte. Much more stable, less likely to leak.
And that made portable devices possible.
Totally. That's what enabled things like, well, our source mentions the Walkman. Remember those?
Do I ever. Powered by AA batteries. Dry cells.
Exactly. That kind of personal portable tech just wasn't feasible before reliable dry cells. A massive leap.
It really was. Oh, interestingly, going back to our Ørsted source, it mentions a scientist named Ritter made the first dry cell way back in 1802.
1802.
Wow. And the first storage battery, like a rechargeable one, in 1803. So the ideas were bubbling up quite early, even if they weren't practical yet.
Fascinating how these things develop in parallel sometimes.
Okay, so we've got early observations, static, electromagnetism, motors, batteries. But modern electronics are ridiculously complex. Tiny chips doing millions of things. How did we get from, say, an electromagnet to an integrated circuit?
The integrated circuit, or IC. That's another revolution. The need really became clear after World War II.
Why then?
Because electronics were getting incredibly complex. Think early computers like ENIX, or even the electronics in a B-29 bomber. They used thousands of vacuum tubes.
Vacuum tubes. Big hot glass things.
Right. And fragile. And when you have thousands of them wired together, the chance of one failing is high. It was called the tyranny of numbers. Reliability plummeted.
I can imagine. One bad tube and the whole thing stops working? What a nightmare.
Totally. Then came the transistor in 1947. Huge improvement. Smaller, less power, more reliable than tubes.
Okay, so transistors helped.
They did. But you still had to wire all these individual transistors together. Still lots of connections, lots of potential failure points.
Still a tyranny of numbers, just smaller numbers.
Sort of, yeah. The idea of putting multiple components onto one single piece of material, integrating them, started floating around in the late 40s, early 50s. People like Werner Jacobi, Jeffrey Dummer, Harwick Johnson had concepts.
So the idea was there. What was stopping them? What were the big hurdles?
Our sources point to three main problems that needed solving, and this happened in the late 1950s. First, just the basic principle of integration. Jack Kilby at Texas Instruments gets credit for that. He built the first prototypes.
Kilby, Texas Instruments, got it. First IC.
Well, first working IC, yes.
Yeah.
But his was what we call a hybrid IC, kind of like different bits stuck onto a base and wired together. Not quite what we use now.
Hybrid versus what's the other kind?
Monolithic. That's where everything, transistors, resistors, capacitors, is built right into the single crystal of semiconductor, like carving it all from one block.
Ah, okay. Much more integrated. So what were the other two problems?
Isolation. How do you stop all those tiny components on the chip from interfering with each other electrically?
Right, they're packed so close together.
Exactly. Kurt Lehovec at Sprague Electric came up with one way, using PN junctions, and Robert Noyce at Fairchild Semiconductor came up with a similar solution independently.
Okay, so isolation solved. What was the third piece?
Connecting everything. Yeah. All those microscopic components needed reliable wires. Robert Noyce, again at Fairchild, figured out how to use aluminum metallization for the connections.
Aluminum, like tiny strips of foil printed on.
Sort of, yeah. And his method built on the planar process developed by Gene Horney, which also helped insulate things better.
Wow. So it sounds like Fairchild was really central to this monolithic idea.
They were. Noyce, Horney. And then in September 1960, a team led by Jay Last at Fairchild, using Noyce and Horney's ideas, demonstrated the first working monolithic integrated circuit.
The first true chip.
That was really it. The booth certificate of modern electronics.
Incredible. What happened then? Smooth sailing.
Not quite. Patent wars, naturally. Mostly between Texas Instruments with Kilby's patents and Fairchild with Noyce's.
Who won? Or who really invented it?
It's complicated. Historians now generally agree multiple people made crucial contributions. Kilby got the Nobel Prize in 2000, but Noyce's monolithic approach is what virtually all modern ICs are based on.
So not one single inventor, but a convergence of ideas and breakthroughs.
Absolutely. It's the perfect example.
What a journey. From, you know, noticing weird fish zapping people.
Right. Through static sparks, Leyden jars, Oersted's compass needle twitching.
Ampere's forces, Faraday's rotations, the first clunky motors.
Developing batteries wet, dry, rechargeable.
And finally, figuring out how to cram thousands, now billions, of transistors onto a tiny sliver of silicon.
It really underscores that this wasn't one person's discovery. It was centuries of cumulative effort, insight, sometimes accidents, by countless people.
And all of that history is humming away inside the device you're probably listening to us on right now. Your phone, your computer. It all rests on this foundation.
It's easy to take for granted. This whole deep dive, it just shows the power of curiosity, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And collaboration, even when it's competitive.
Makes you wonder, doesn't it? Given how connected research is now globally, what are the strange phenomena scientists are noticing today?
What odd little experimental results might be the seeds of the next revolution? What are we on the cusp of understanding now that seems as mysterious as the thunder of the Nile did back then?
A provocative thought to end on. What future breakthroughs are just waiting for that connecting insight?